Welcome to the Legacy Podcast. This podcast is a series of conversations centered around understanding the values, beliefs, and intentions behind leaving a legacy. You will hear from successful business owners just like yourself who want to leave an impact for generations to come. Let's get started.
Welcome to the Business Legacy Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So join us on our journey while we talk with business owners like yourself about their successes, failures, and legacy that they want to leave behind. Whether you're a present business owner, recently retired owner, or looking to build a legacy, we tear down the walls of cultural sensitivity to help you explore your own legacy. What do you want your legacy to look like? So this week, we're interviewing Michael Butler. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, we brought Michael on because he really kind of dives into part of the business process, which is looking at a legacy if you're looking to ever sell your business. Michael is an M&A advisor, and I'll let him give more accolades about what he's done than me because I think he'll do a better job at it. But I think it's important to look at all these different aspects of the business because at some point in time, you're going to come upon this issue of transition. So we wanted you to get a little bit of an education about what this entails and how to think about it for when this comes into your future. So Michael, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get started in the M&A advisory work?
Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, I'll sort of maybe I'll go all the way back just to kind of my career history because I think it helps to understand where I am today. I started out after college as a CPA, worked for Ernst, both in audit and consulting, then became a chief financial officer for a company. And during that time in that role, I did several acquisitions of companies, and actually our company got acquired and I survived the acquisitions, started to work for the new owner for a period of time. And I was just finishing up an MBA program at the time. And as soon as I finished, I decided to make a move. And I joined a large financial services organization, worked with them in several different areas. And through that process, we acquired a number of companies and invested in companies along the way. And I participated in both the sale and exit of some of those. And then most recently, the role before my M&A role, I was a partner in a venture capital firm. And in that, we invested in early stage technology companies, not just invested, but also sold those companies as a result. Obviously, the way we monetize those was through an exit. Then ultimately, my partner and I decided not to raise the next fund, and I moved on to investment banking about 4 years ago. And in that investment banking role, we advise business owners on both the sale and the purchase of businesses along the way. But why I went into so much detail on my background is just all those different experiences will show you that I've been involved in sort of all sides of the table regarding M&A transactions, both from the buyer and the seller and the caretaker of those businesses along the way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the background. That's really important because you have kind of a broad range of expertise here. So why get into the M&A advisory, or I guess you call it investment banking? How did you really get into this? Like what drew you to this as opposed to other things you could have done with your background?
Yeah, thank you. Always been involved and interested in deals and wanting to really for myself learn the ins and outs of buying and selling businesses. I thought that was one of the most fascinating things. A personal friend of mine had become a business broker. And as we were just sitting around chatting one day, I talked about the fact that if I wasn't doing venture capital, I'd love to do what he did. And he got sort of excited about that. And he wanted me to join his firm. I ultimately decided not to join him. But in my exploration of the field, I met another gentleman who was working in the investment banking arena. And the difference, Kirk, between investment banking and business brokerage, business brokerage is generally involved with the sale of smaller businesses, generally businesses that are, I'll say, less than $1 million of earnings. Investment banking is generally involved in larger businesses. And as a result of that, I sort of gravitated towards the larger businesses, liked what I was doing. But I found a local firm right in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, called Footprint Capital, that was doing that kind of work, and decided to join them to check it out. And that checking out became kind of the career I'm in now. And I'm doing it full time and enjoying it quite a bit.
Let me just ask you, in your experience, I'm sure you've worked with a number of business owners. How should business owners be thinking about this? I know obviously, you're looking at this from, hey, we work with businesses when they're looking to sell, But, you know, business owners, they might own their business for 1 year or 50 years. What should business owners be thinking about when in the concept of an exit?
Well, first of all, they should be thinking about it. that's probably the biggest thing. And many don't. Many don't plan for how they're going to, you know, dispose of their business at some point in time. Dispose is probably the bad term to use, but exit it. Whether they're going to sell to employees, pass to a family member, sell to an outside third party. And a lot of times people don't plan for that. They feel like they're going to be in their business and in it forever. I'm of the opinion that you should be, you know, you shouldn't start a business without knowing ultimately where it should take you and what you want to do for you and ultimately how you will exit it at some point in time. You know, a lot of our clients are people that started businesses in their early, let's say their 20s or 30s, and have been at it for, you know, sometimes 20, 30, 40 years, and have finally decided it's time. They don't have a family member to pass it to. It's time to sell it to somebody. And quite often that sale involves selling it to a third party, selling it to another business owner or a private equity firm or what we call a strategic investor. And a strategic investor, just for clarity's sake, is someone who is in the business, in the industry, let's say, but might be a competitor, could be a customer, could be a supplier, someone who has or even shares, you know, a similar customer base. So back on your question, though, you know, the planning for this and always kind of knowing where you want to take the business and ultimately, you know, planning for that exit is important. You know, sometimes we'll get a phone call from a business owner and they've decided this because of a personal situation, let's say a divorce, a death, an illness, or just complete burnout. They're ready to exit the business. And they really haven't done, in many cases, a lot of planning for that exit. And there's a lot of things that need to be done to get that ready, get that business ready for business in order to maximize its value. Whether that's tax planning or just kind of kind of organizational planning around the sale. So the point is, you know, to think about the exit all the time. There's a good book out there. It was a bestseller a number of years ago called Built to Sell. And I always liked that title of that book is how do you build a company ultimately to sell it? And if you think about that all the way along in the process, you're going to be in a much better situation come exit time.
Good. No, I appreciate that insight. So let's talk about the process a little bit, because, you know, let's just say I've got my business and I'm looking to sell it. Obviously, I want to maximize the value, right? I mean, that's probably the point, although there are probably other aspects that are important too. But what can I do to maximize the value of my business as I'm looking to sell it a year from now? Like, what are the things I can do to maximize the value of my business from now until then?
Yeah, great question. A lot of things. First of all, making sure that from a tax point of view, it's in the best possible way to avoid excess taxation or avoid, I'll say, avoidable taxes. And I don't want to go into that. That's a whole topic on expertise area. But just making sure the house is ordered from a tax point of view. But more practically, what you want to do is I always try to make sure that people avoid what we see are the major pitfalls in valuing a business. The number one thing we see is what we call owner dominance. And by that, I mean that the owner of the business completely dominates the business. They're the person that brings in new customers. They're the person that runs the operations on a day-to-day basis. And without them, the business really doesn't have a lot of value or a lot of direction, if you will. And so that's one thing that owners have to be conscious of. If they're trying to sell a business and ultimately ride off into the sunset and hopefully have a nice check as a result of that, they need to be thinking about is who's going to run the business in their absence. And if they've built a management team that can carry on without them, you know, that's the number one thing that a new buyer is going to be looking at. Or they're going to require that the selling owner, you know, stick around for a while. And it's not uncommon to have some sort of transition period. But if you can equip your management team to run the business in your absence, that's just the great first step. Another common pitfall we see is what's called customer concentration, and that's where a lot of the sales for a company are concentrated with one particular customer, one particular relationship. And as you might guess, a buyer is concerned about that because they think, hey, if the owner walks away after selling the business, will that customer go away? Will that personal relationship that owner has had with that customer transcend or not make the transition well? So as a result of that, one thing we look at is we look at what the spread of business is amongst customers and try to look at the most important customers and to see if there's a contract in place, let's say, that would ensure the long-term viability of that business, or just a long-term relationship that's bigger than just the owner's relationship with the business. So those are two items. There's quite a few others, Kirk, but those are just two things that we'll, you know, as we're starting to look at a company, and we spend a good bit of time up front with a company, making sure we understand how they make money, what's important, their obviously their history, their future projections, and looking at those two things, such as owner dominance and customer concentration that I just mentioned, those two of many that we start to look at to determine how can we best position the business for sale, in your example, a year from now. And there's a lot of changes that can be made.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about those two points, because you mentioned owner dominance. I mean, certainly, I think any business should be, you know, you should be able to scale it, right? You should be able to work on your business, not in your business. And
absolutely,
being a business owner gives you that freedom, but only if you create that freedom within the business.
Yeah.
So what are some ways people should be thinking about that? Because I think there's been a lot of good books written about this on how to do that. But how should people be thinking about that? Like, what should the end result look like to maximize the value?
Yeah. Well, I'll jump to a little story. We were engaging a company and was asking about how involved the owner was in the day-to-day operations. And the way he explained it to me was this. He said, "Michael, I go hunting 10 weeks a year. And I go in up in northern Canada where no one can reach me. So I'm able to leave my business for 10 weeks a year without having any contact with the office." So for me, that told us that he has got his company in a way, in a position that his management team is carrying the job when he's not there. Now, certainly he gets involved on the strategy and other things like that, as many owners do. But the fact that a person can leave the business, can take a vacation, can take an afternoon off, for goodness sakes, without having to check their phone or email every couple minutes, is the first key to doing that. But, you know, it goes down to just the basics of hiring good people and giving them responsibility. You know, another thing is sometimes when a buyer will come in, if the owner, you know, if the buyer comes in to interview the owner and the management team, making sure the owner doesn't answer all the questions. You know, if an owner is constantly the person with all the information and the rest of the management team is sitting around the conference table with no information, no role in that that presentation of the company, you can kind of tell the company's being, you know, dominated by the owner. So that's one suggestion we give to the owner is let your other people talk. Make sure we assign them the great roles that they have and they can talk about their areas and highlight to a potential buyer how valuable they are going forward and kind of minimize the owner's, like I said, dominance of the business or role in the business. Doesn't mean you take your eye off the ball, but it means you just, you know, manage your people to the point where you hire good people and give them responsibility.
Okay. No, I like that. So let's talk a little bit about the customer concentration, because that seems to be maybe an issue. You know, if I've got Walmart as my customer, you know, what do you do about that?
I mean, Yeah, and it's great to have big customers, but typically what the level of which where it starts to get concerning is when a customer is more than 15% of your revenue, if one customer is that large. So that's a number we tend to look at. You know, if you've got a customer that's 5% of your business or even 10% of your business, that's generally okay. But if you've got someone that's over, you know, I talked to somebody the other day, they said, yes, this one customer is 40% of my business. And that's a little bit concerning. There was no long-term contract in place. There's certainly a business relationship. But if that company goes away after the owner leaves, or if it goes away even if the owner is not leaving, obviously puts that company in a bad spot. So looking for that. So the best thing I think you can do as a business owner, you don't want to just turn down customers because they could be large. You certainly want large customers. But having you know, contracts in place for long-term contracts or long-term recurring revenue type of things, you know, puts that buyer in a much more comfortable feeling around acquiring the business.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, when we're looking at this process of exiting the business, you know, I would imagine, unless you're a serial entrepreneur and you're somebody with your background, maybe in venture capital or what have you, you know, you probably know exactly what to do. But for most business owners, this is probably their only exit. And, you know, this is their retirement for a lot of people. So what kind of a team should this person have in place if they want to do this right? Because there's a lot of aspects of sale. You're just talking about, you know, finding a buyer and transitioning, and there's a lot to it. I don't mean to minimize it, but besides that, there are other aspects to this. Can you talk a little bit about the other aspects and who people should be looking at to develop a team?
Yeah, great. Great question. Yeah, we're just one member of the team. And let me talk about some of the others. One is a good M&A attorney, an attorney that works in mergers and acquisitions. You know, quite often we'll talk to a business owner and they'll say, oh, I'll just use my normal corporate counsel that's helped me set up the company a lot of years ago. And it manages all of our general issues of employee issues and other things that come up on the legal side, you know, other contractual issues. And we generally would advise against that unless that person has a particular interest or has worked in the merger and acquisition space. Quite often, if they're with a larger firm, we can find someone inside their firm that focuses on that type of practice. You want an experienced attorney side by side with you that understands market terms and what's happening in the M&A world. So that's one team member. Secondly, is a good CPA. If you're using someone for taxes at a minimum or doing a reviewed or audited financials, they're an important member of the team, helping to communicate what your company is about from a financial point of view. And you may have some of those resources on the inside of your company, but you also might outsource some of those. But also, you know, the component of that is the taxation as well, making sure that the company, as I've said earlier, is properly set up to avoid unnecessary taxation in the sale of a company. We certainly play a role of being, you know, sort of the advisor on the transaction itself. We get involved when in preparing the company, taking it to market. But at the end of the day, when the company, you know, when the company transaction is completed, when it's closed, we really don't have a role going forward. And that's where your financial advisor plays a super important role in preparing the company, looking at what are the needs you have on a personal basis to, let's say this is a retirement you're of a retirement age and you're not expecting to work after this company is sold. You know, are there going to be enough resources that'll come from the business sale to support your livelihood going in the future? So knowing what you need to get out of the business is important. Sometimes, you know, hopefully there's a match between what you need and what the company's worth. But then ultimately, when the company closes, there's usually a large sum of money that needs to be invested and invested wisely to have it last a lifetime, if that's the case. So financial advisors are very important. Insurance people also get involved in the process as well. The transition of insurance from one organization or one owner to another is important as well. But those are some of the major advisory groups in the team. And as investment bankers, because we are sort of focused on the transaction and have experience there, we help to coordinate many of those roles, play sort of a quarterback role, for lack of a better term, kind of getting someone to a close.
So what are some of the, and I appreciate that insight, because I think a lot of people, they don't know what they don't know, right? Like mm-hmm. that must come up a lot and they're looking for that kind of advice. So what are some of the pitfalls you've seen people kind of fall into when they go through this process?
Yeah, you know, it can fall into a lot of categories. I've got, a lot of war stories, if you will. I'll try not to roll them out or make them too long here, but, you know, really just being prepared, like we said, early preparation makes it key. Yeah, the biggest thing I think that we hear, or you can hear, you'll hear said, is that time can kill deals. And by that, we mean this. These transactions last anywhere from 6 to 9 months and sometimes even beyond. And with that, they can get a little fatiguing. You're trying to run your business as a business owner day to day. And in the background, this effort to sell your company can take a lot of time, effort, and energy. It's almost like for a while you'll have kind of two jobs. You know, our goal is to minimize that as much as possible, bringing our expertise in selling a company and easing the process and easing the burden on a business owner of doing that. But, you know, after a while, both the buyers and the sellers get sort of tired in the process. This deal fatigue is a term that's used out there. And so what we try to do ahead of time is we try to do a lot of the homework, a lot of the heavy lifting before we take the company to market. And by that, we is a good example. You know, when we get involved with a company, we set up a virtual data room. And that's really just a way to upload information to a secure site that can ultimately be shared with the buyer at the right time. And with that, by doing a lot of work ahead of time, it can be sort of onerous and take a little bit of administrative time. but it'll minimize and smooth the process of getting to a closed sale. You know, the final part of the closed sale is a lot of work with the attorneys, a lot of work on what's called the purchase agreement. And whether you're purchasing, the buyer is purchasing stock or assets, and that's a whole nother discussion. But getting through that process can take some time, the back and forth of attorneys. And attorneys, as an example, right now at this time of year are towards the end of a year, get pretty busy. There's a lot of, December 31st closes they're trying to get accomplished before they flip over into the next year. And so it can be a busy time for accountants, attorneys, and whatnot, and ourselves included, to get through a transaction. But I guess that's the first pitfall, is making sure that things are done well so the deal moves along as smoothly and as quickly as possible. And then one other, pitfall that kind of comes from that, Kirk, is the fact that we see quite often, business owners who get so wrapped up in the transaction, the sale of their company, they sort of take their eye off the ball from their day-to-day business. And a lot of times what can happen is you can have a bad quarter, a bad month, whatever the case may be. And that's really unfortunately the worst time to have a bad quarter or a bad month. It's right in the final, fourth quarter, if you will, of a sale process. And so, as you might guess, usually what happens is a price is agreed upon based upon financial information. And as you're going through and finishing up due diligence and finishing up the legal side of a transaction, if all of a sudden the monthly results show that the business has taken a turn to the south, that can concern a buyer quite a bit. And it might give a buyer a cause to come back and say, I think we need to retrade this or renegotiate the purchase price. And you certainly don't want that occurring at the end. We've been fortunate in a couple of regards where the business has actually had a much better month than was to be expected towards the end, which is great news. And certainly you can even go back, and if you want to try to renegotiate a higher price, that's even possible. Sometimes difficult to do. But with that, just making sure that a business owner, and the management team keep their eye on the ball, and nothing causes the transaction to be in jeopardy towards the end.
I'd love to hear like a good story and a bad story about kind of that you've gone through with this process, just to kind of give people some ideas of maybe some things that have, I won't say gone wrong, but things people should be, thinking about.
Yeah. I guess I'll say, I'll give you a very good example. We had a situation, actually we had a number of transactions that were affected by COVID. We started the process of selling, and actually we were pretty far down the road. And all of a sudden COVID hit, and the business that we were selling was very consumer oriented. And as a result of that, the traffic into the business kind of came to a screeching halt from the standpoint of sales. And with that, we decided, to take it upon ourselves to actually pause the transaction, pause the process, if you will, as we call it. And so we decided to pause it, wait till things started to return to normal. It ended up being about a three and a half month pause, restarted the process, kind of picked up right where it was. The good news is we waited till really the company had sort of come back to a pre-COVID level. And they were fortunate enough to return to a number that was very similar to what they had done before. So that was a good situation where an unexpected item that no one anticipated caused a large delay in the process. I could have turned it permanently off, but the good news was the business did return. We've obviously seen some businesses that have been meaningfully impacted by COVID, and actually we've seen some on the plus side as well. We're representing a small chain of urgent care facilities, and right now they continue to be very busy, and were very busy during COVID as a result, doing COVID testing and whatnot. And they actually had better years as opposed to worse years in their past history. And by the same token, you have to look at that and say, well, that goodness that occurred during COVID is not going to continue. So we actually had to take that impact, that positive impact, sort of out of the numbers, if you will, from a buyer's point of view, taking a look at that, and so on. But I hope that kind of gives you a bit of an idea. And I certainly have other stories I can go into, but I want to make sure we get to all the questions we've got here today.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I think it's helpful to hear some of the stories. And I know COVID obviously affected a lot of people. So if you're looking for selling a business, it's, make sure you have your financials in order. I know some businesses did better and some did worse, but, obviously the impact has to be accounted for. So let me just ask you, just for reference for the listeners here, what are the things you look for when you're working for a business, like in terms of you know, size, in terms of industry, you know, things like that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so we're, I mentioned earlier, we're based out of Columbus, Ohio, but we actually do business nationally. In fact, we even do, we've actually sold a couple of businesses in Canada as well. But with that, you know, the things that we are specialists at are businesses that probably have at least about $2 million of earnings. We use a term that the industry uses quite often called EBITDA. And EBITDA, that word is really an acronym for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And but it really, it's kind of a proxy for cash flow of a company, if you will. And to that end, you know, our focus has been companies with at least 2 million of EBITDA and higher. We worked in quite a few industries, from healthcare. We've sold some physician practices, particularly ophthalmology and others. We've also worked in consumer services, HVAC and plumbing related companies, logistics, light manufacturing, business services, and so on. So we've touched a lot of different industries. But even if we, you know, even being based in Columbus, Ohio, we do a lot of work virtually. The world has become a lot more used to virtual communication, as you and I are doing today, Kirk, on the podcast. We're not physically together, but we're able to pull off this podcast in this way. And so we're able to work with companies all around the country, excuse me. In terms of things that are very attractive, you know, if you have any component of recurring revenue to your business, that can be very attractive to a buyer. And by recurring revenue, it can really take a variety of different things, whether it's a long-term contract or it's a subscription-based business that with automatic renewals is an example. Those types of things, you know, one example that we had just coming out of the HVAC business is many consumers are now buying, you know, protection plans for their HVAC equipment, their heating and air conditioning equipment. And that component of an HVAC business is viewed to be very attractive. There's a monthly or annual fee that gets paid automatically. And that, you know, as you might guess, that's attractive to a buyer and great for a seller of a business, even just an ongoing business. If you have a certain component of revenue you can count on month in and month out. Those are some of the things we look for, again, across a lot of industries. There's a lot of industry specific things we could get into, of course, but for the interest of time, we won't go there. But hopefully that starts to answer that question.
Yeah. Are there certain industries that you focus on more than others?
Yeah. I think, you know, it's been a variety of things. Our history has been, like I said, the light manufacturing, business services. When I say business services, things such as consulting services, we've done a good number of practices there. The HVAC and plumbing has been a focus lately, and ophthalmology practices lately. These are eye doctors that are working, in many cases, doing surgeries and whatnot. It's a very demanded field right now, with a great future ahead in terms of the aging demographic of the population. More and more people are needing eye care and that sort of thing, and as a result, investors are very interested in those types of businesses these days.
So one other question I would ask, because I think this is going to be helpful for the business owners that are listening, is, you know, there's multiple types of exits that can happen. And, you know, most people just think, oh, I'm just going to go, you know, I'm going to call Michael and he's just going to sell it to some random company out there. But there's so many different types, both inside and outside sales. Can you talk a little bit about those and how people should be thinking about this?
Sure. You know, it all depends on what your objectives are in selling a business, of course. But let's talk about the inside sales. So first of all, the most obvious one is really the passing down of a business to a family member. You know, that for years and years, that was really the most common thing, that a son or daughter would take over the business from mom and dad and take it into the future. These days, though, there's actually seems to be less affinity for that than there have been in the past. I think there's less I guess, of a requirement that the families are putting on the next generation to take over the business, whether the son or daughter want to go do something else, or whether the business owners have to make sure they can sell it to an outside third party in order to fund their retirement. All those kinds of things come into play these days. Another type of inside transfer could be a sale to the management team. So you could have developed a great management team that is running the business for you on a day-to-day basis, and they may have an interest in taking it into the future. Usually the biggest problem with the selling to a management team is they usually don't have the financial wherewithal in order to, you know, buy the company. They don't have great sources of capital to invest in the company. And the companies usually, if it's any kind of a successful company, take some resources to do it, and maybe taking a bank loan, but that can be difficult as well. Another thing is an ESOP. People have maybe heard about this. It's called an employee stock ownership plan. And that's basically when you're transferring the ownership to all the employees of the company. This is a great thing for employees. Can be, I should say, but it's complicated and it doesn't meet the needs of every kind of owner that's looking to dispose of the business. So those are some of the inside. On the outside, when you sell it to a third party, there are different types of third parties that are buying businesses out there. One of the most attractive is what's called a strategic buyer. And I think I mentioned this earlier. And a strategic buyer is someone who's already involved in your industry, is an example. And with that, in the case of, I'll just go back to that HVAC example that I mentioned earlier. We sold a company for someone, and he sold it to a company that's already acquired a number of different HVAC practices, and they're aggregating them together into a larger company. And they're going to have an opportunity to share some services, whether they share a combined back office system, or share payroll, or accounts payable, or the buying of equipment. All those kinds of things can be very synergistic and can help to reduce costs. On the plus side, they might be able to help sell, or help with marketing efforts. They might be able to tell you, here's how the best way is to advertise and to get new customers for the business. So with that, there's some pluses of selling to a strategic. That's one outside buyer. Another could be a financially interested buyer. And by that, we mean this could be, many people have heard about private equity. These are pools of money looking to buy businesses with the goal of ultimately selling them at some point in time in the future and getting a financial gain. This could be someone who's involved in an industry or just getting into an industry. And obviously, they've got certain requirements and so on. Yeah, and the next group is family offices. Quite often, these are wealthy individuals that have an office running their affairs, and they are typically were investors in the past and into general pools, but are getting more and more interested in buying businesses. And the last group is just individuals, wealthy individuals. It might be a retired executive from a company who is wanting to do something in their post corporate life. And we see individuals that have a good bit of financial wherewithal in order to buy a business. So that kind of lists some of the different inside and outside exit options, and obviously there are others, but that's kind of the major categories.
Yeah, no, thanks for that insight. That's helpful, because I know from what I've been hearing anyway that the market is, I don't want to say peaking, but it's certainly a hot market where there are a lot of buyers of businesses right now. So, do you see, kind of in your experience, how do you see these trends working? Like, is this a good time for people to be looking to sell, or do you see things continuing to improve, or what are your kind of insight?
I tell you, I definitely consider this to be a seller's market. Multiples are good, valuations are good, that really loom well in terms of someone maximizing the value of their business. Will it continue? Good question. I would say that right now, I think there's a good chance that this will continue. I don't know that it'll get much better, however. So I guess that's the point of view I've had for the past couple of years here, is that we're at such a great point in time, and COVID, sort of took a dent out of that, took the wind out of our sails for a period of time. But things seem to be back. And with that, volume of transactions is getting larger. But if you're a business owner thinking about it, this is definitely a good time. And we always say that certain things have to line up. Your business has to be ready. The industry has to be ready. And sort of that's what I'm relating to. This is a good time in the industry to sell most businesses. And and you have to be ready as an owner. And one of the questions we typically ask of owners is, what are you going to do with this business? And what the first question we typically get from a buyer is, why is this business being sold? And so it's always good to have an answer of here's what I'm running to, as opposed to running from. Someone doesn't want to be buying a business when the industry is going to take a turn to the down, or a major competitor is entering the industry that's affecting everybody in the business, as an example. So having some good answers around why you're selling a business and what are you going to do afterwards is always interesting for a buyer to know.
Yeah, I want to kind of touch on this before we wrap it up, you know, in terms of what people should be doing after. I mean, that can be a challenge, right? I mean, you spend your whole life or a good portion of it running this business, and this business is, you know, it's like a family member, right? It's you're just kind of moving on. So how should people be looking at that transition kind of from an emotional standpoint?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's challenging for sure, because a lot of people wrap up their identity in their business. This is what this is their baby. And it's a very emotional time. I just attended an employee meeting when the gentleman who was selling the company, you know, was telling his employees, and he got kind of choked up, as you might guess. It's been something that's been his life. And actually, it's kind of interesting. He was going to continue to work for the company after the sale for a period of time. And the business closed on a Friday, and I happened to reach out to him on a Saturday to see how he was doing and how his celebration was. And he was at his office on a Saturday, couldn't change the old habits. And so he said, my bank account's a lot bigger, but I'm sitting here in the office. So with that, yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think it's if you try to determine what you want to do, you know, how you want to give back, and whether that's community service, whether that's starting another business, helping family members, whatever the case may be, I think having those objectives will have you feel not as empty, if you will, after a sale, because it can kind of feel that way, even though the money can be good and the legacy for your employees is good. And that's one of the things maybe I want to touch on, Kirk, sort of on that topic is the legacy for, you know, this is called the Legacy Podcast. And, you know, what people are doing is when they sell their company, they do have a legacy, and whether, you know, that business is going to continue in the future is obviously very important to them. And they want to take care of the employees that have taken care of them for so many years in terms of growing a business. But making sure that there's got to be good chemistry with the buyer and a good idea of what that buyer is going to do with the business in the future. And things can always change with what the buyer does. But knowing what the plan is, you know, to keep the employees around and keep the business growing and so on. And even all the way down to branding, is the name of the company going to change in the future? If you're getting, you know, bought by a large behemoth kind of company that's got some pretty powerful brand, it's sometimes pretty obvious for them to want to change the name of the company over time or immediately. But those are the kinds of things you need to think of in terms of beyond the money is what's going to happen with my business in the future and to my employees.
Yeah, that's. I appreciate you bringing that up, because that's an important side of this. Is it's not just about the money, you know. There's the emotional part of it. There's the social part of it, right? Like, this is your family. You had these employees. You trained them. You know, you're in charge of making sure that they can provide for their families. And
absolutely,
there's a lot to that.
And you brought service to customers for a lot of years. You want to make sure your customers in the future, if they're the same customers, recurring customers, as an example, want to make sure they're taken care of and the service levels don't drop off and things like that. So a lot of important considerations going into choosing a finalist. You know, when we first start talking to a business owner, quite often it's very focused on, you know, what's the, I'd like to get the most I can for my business. But it's a combination of, we say, price, terms of sale, you know, if the money's going to be paid all up front or over time or whatever the case may be, plus the chemistry you have with the buyer going forward.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. So as we kind of wrap it up, what are some final thoughts that you can leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I think I'll go back to the first things we first talked about, Kirk, is just planning is key. Those that are the most prepared do the best and are the happiest with the results. And it's always easy to think about the always to delay a decision around an exit, because it's something that's not, you know, pressing, if you will. It's not on your plate at the moment. But the one thing I like to think about is, you know, sometimes you'll receive an unsolicited offer from a company. We had a very young guy who I got to know, and he said, "Hey, Michael, I received a really outstanding offer from a great partner. This is the kind of company I want to sell to." And even though he was only 38 at the time, he said, I want to entertain it. Can you help me do that?" And so we helped guide him through the process. But the first thing we encouraged him to do is, do we want to bring some competition into this? We want to reach out to others. He was pretty certain that the company that he was going to, if this was the company that would ultimately acquired him, this was the right company, and he didn't want to look any further. But with that, we helped him through that process. But he was, you know, as you might guess, as a 38-year-old guy, he was not really preparing for retirement in any way. So we sort of had to do a little bit of legwork to kind of, you know, make sure that everything was aligned the right way for a seller to take it over and for him to exit. He ultimately decided not to exit, but we helped him through the process and helped him feel good about the process. But for him, at least, that kind of trial run, for lack of a better term, got him thinking about, when do I want to exit this business, on and what terms? You know, when am I going to be done with this business? And it may not be it. Back on point, prepare early, prepare often, think about it a lot, visit with people like myself, and get your thoughts together around your options.
Great. Well, Mike, I really appreciate you kind of sharing your wisdom with us today. I know, we'll probably have you back on in the future. I mean, this is one of those, ever evolving topics that we keep needing to touch on, because, every business owner is going to have this happen, whether you're planning it or not planning it.
Right.
So really important. So thank you again for joining us. Where can people find more about you, Michael?
Yeah. It's Michael Butler. And feel free to reach out to me at Footprint Capital, footprintcapital.com. You'll see some information there. I'll be glad to give email address, mbutler, B-U-T-L-E-R, at footprintcapital.com. Feel free, if I can help you out in any way in your thinking, in your process, I'd be glad to do that.
Thanks again for joining us, Michael.
Thank you.
So that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us on the Business Legacy Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at thebusinesslegacypodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests you're going to want to hear. Have a great week ahead. Remember, no one will care about your legacy like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Legacy Podcast. Now, if you can do us a favor and leave a review, any type of stars on any platform that you use, it would be greatly appreciated. For more information about us, the other co-hosts, and the Legacy Podcast, go to businesslegacypodcast.com. That's businesslegacypodcast.com. Have a great day.